I think, widely known outside of California that inmates in California Department of Corrections camps, some of our sort of what we think of as the lowest risk inmates, are assigned to, or are they technically are volunteering for firefighter duty. I don't know how much of it is volunteering versus more feeling obligated to be a part of a crew. That's a great question for someone who's been on the inside. But I worked with them on several of the fires that I worked on. And, you know, the thing that always impressed me was that they were incredibly dedicated to the work that they were doing. And they were people that I felt safe working alongside. I actually specifically remember working on a fire in some incredibly steep terrain in Monterey County. And I took a horrible, nasty fall. I tripped on a rock and went down a hill. And immediately there were several inmate firefighters helping me up and making sure I was okay. And they were just really hardworking, kind individuals. And we shared fire camp with them. And they're all there, trying to do the same types of work that we were doing as employees for the Forest Service. But of course, it wasn't equal because they were getting paid almost nothing, and they were still incarcerated. And it is, something that has raised a lot of concerns among the firefighting community, particularly because it has always been a real challenge for inmates to then get those same firefighting jobs once they are released. And despite the fact that they have this substantial amount of experience doing firefighting and being out on these large fire events, they sort of have this stigma, and it makes it very, very difficult to get hired. In fact, it was almost impossible to hire inmates until some recent changes in the law. But that has been a long concern in terms of equity issues. They're still doing the same difficult job. There have been several inmates that have been killed on wildfires. And of course, they don't get any of the types of fanfare accolades or family benefits that other firefighters do if that happens or if they're injured. And there's this real question about how appropriate is it for the state of California to be using inmates to fight fires in the first place?
Crystal Colden, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Ernest Ranglin, the John Butler Trio, and Hank Williams.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Andy Wawo looks a scream. Have him on my wall. Andy Wawo, silver stream. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is landscape photographer Mike Voss. Mike's here talking about his new show, Fragile Tenuous Worlds, which is on now at Laura Vincent Design and Gallery at 824 Northwest Davis Street in the Old Town through the end of July. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus for the first time, Mike.
Thanks for having me, Joseph.
So you do this amazing large format color photography, but double exposure. So every image is a kind of a puzzle. You're always trying to work out, what am I looking at? You always do landscape. So there's no people in there to kind of confuse things. Just tell us in like a minute how you operate. You know, you shoot on film. How do you know when to shoot the second image on the same piece of film?
Yeah, so I use a 4x5 film camera. It's a large format camera, and I do all the exposures within the camera. There's nothing that happens in post or digitally added later. And I'm very intentional about the landscapes that I photograph. I use a manual camera, so everything's very slow, and it gives me time to be patient and really think about what I want to say with an image and what location might pair and have a nice conversation with that first exposure that I've made.
To get right into it, as you come into Laura's gallery, you come in the down the corridor, through the door, and make a kind of a 180, and the first image on your right is a small 16 by 20 inch photo in a brown wooden frame. And so the two images I see are a sort of yellow, sulfurous, kind of wet rock landscape, like you'd see at a hot spring. And, you know, there's sort of blue, there's more blue water in the background. And then a tree line, a horizon with sort of fir trees. And then there's a triangular roof, like the gable of a house or a building, with sort of shingles and a kind of round knob on the top. And that's the two images. You have a landscape with a big kind of pyramid stuck right in the middle. So immediately I start thinking, you know, are these in the same place? Are they related? Is it some kind of national park kind of thing? And then the blues at the top kind of faded to green on the sort of left, on the right half of the image. So I wonder, you know, why that is. So just tell us what you call it, a chimeric vision.
Chimeric vision. Yeah, it's based on a myth. And also the, you know, there's a different definition of chimera too, which is something that is hoped for, but maybe impossible to achieve. And that's something I think about here, where, you know, there is just a hint or like a phantom of a human-made building here within a landscape. And normally I like to make work that is recognizable and relatable and communicates a specific idea to the viewer. But here I wanted to explore a little bit more of the abstract possibilities of combining these two layers. And I think a lot about, you know, this idea that there are no perfectly straight lines in nature. So I just wanted to have a very slight hint of those very stark straight lines within a natural landscape. And of course, with these hot springs, there's some really incredible orange and yellow and greens that are involved here. And in terms of when I make these images and how they're going to blend, since I do everything in the camera, I'm not totally certain how well it's going to work and what the ultimate outcome is going to be. There's a level of chaos there that I actually think fondly of and I really appreciate. So when certain colors come out and certain shapes appear in certain places, there is some control on my end of what will happen there, but there's oftentimes things that are unpredictable and things that I personally can't explain, which is very exciting for me to make this work, and I'm happy to share it with others when that does happen.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, looking around the gallery, it's usually a building, like a lighthouse, a water tower, some mining equipment, office building, airplane, things like that. And then there's a landscape in the background, like mountains and rivers and things. And this one, I guess the building is not very, there's not much of it. And what happens is the darker parts of the of one image get kind of drowned out or, you know, overridden by the lighter parts of the other image. So the front of this building was all in shadow, you said, and that's why the kind of yellow, sulfurous, rocky, wet foreground kind of dominates.
Exactly. So whatever lies in shadow or has darker elements to it, the other exposure that gets made, that will reveal more of that second exposure. So it is something that I think about and plan for when I photograph locations. And there's a lot of preparation that goes into thinking about where the sun is going to be, where the shadows are in certain buildings, and where the shadows are in nature. So that's something that I do have to keep in mind when I'm photographing these places. I have to be very intentional about when I go. And there are a lot of successes here, but there's a lot of failures, I'd say, that don't get seen. There's a lot of trial and error that happened, especially in the early days of this series that I began working on. So always grateful when it works out. And like I said, there's always some happy accidents that happen.
But you've done loads of these before, right? You have a book. So these are the latest. And why did you go so abstract on this particular one, a chimeric vision? And then now I'm thinking, because there's sort of steam coming off the water, mm-hmm. that's what makes the dark green into this sort of faded turquoise. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that in the early days, like, I really wanted to talk through these nonverbal means about the relationship between the human landscape and the natural one. And there's been a lot of back and forth over the last 3 or 4 years when I was making this series of showing this work to people and seeing what their response is to it. So playing with the idea of making more abstract images or more straightforward images and just seeing how people responded to that. And ultimately the goal for me is that I want to help bridge a more personal connection to the landscape for the viewer, because something that, you know, nature for a lot of people is very abstract in general, and it's hard for them to relate to and connect to. And as you mentioned, I don't photograph people, so it's harder for people to connect to landscapes than I'd say a portrait of someone, because they can't see themselves reflected in the image here. So it's more about experimentation on my part of what is going to communicate the story that I'm trying to tell more effectively, and mm-hmm. Just trying different methods to do that. I think that especially now that photography is very accessible for people, especially digital photography, there's a lot of photographs that happen very rapidly, and when there's an opportunity to take a beat and slow down and really think about what you're photographing, it also helps you to appreciate the landscape a lot more. It's one thing that I really value about my manual camera is that everything has to be done by hand, so it feels like I'm making something with my hands. But because it's so slow and intentional, it really forces me to build a relationship with that landscape. And so it helps me to understand the best way to photograph it in a way that honors what this landscape actually is and how it felt to me when I was there. And it also, I think, more accurately captures that landscape because it captures the emotional experience and not just the visual one as well.
So let's talk about this. I think it's the biggest one in the show. It's on the far wall. It's got kind of pride of place. It's called Wrapped Up Against the Cold, and it's 40 by 50 inches, and it's like a rocky beach with a lighthouse and a lighthouse keeper's kind of building. And then the background, more faded, is this beautiful, craggy, snowy mountain range. I always need to know where you are. That's before I can understand anything.
Yeah, so one of the exposures was made on the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska, and incredible place, really beautiful. And the other exposure was made on San Juan Island, on the north end of the island at a lighthouse there called Lime Kiln. And both of these places are two of my favorite places in the world, so I was very grateful to get to travel to both. And as I mentioned before, since I do everything in the camera and I don't have to shoot roll film where I have to advance past the exposure that I just made, I can save that film and shoot it at a much later date. And the time difference between these two exposures was about a month. So I can just save the exposure that I made and really think about and be very intentional about the other landscape that I want to include with the first one. The connection to me is this object that is almost made obsolete now due to modern technology. And I think a lot about, you know, kind of antiquated human-made objects like this, where it doesn't really serve any kind of functional purpose anymore, and it's guarding the shoreline indefinitely out here. And so I thought a lot about that. And when I was in Alaska, this very wild place, very remote, you can go an entire day without seeing anybody. I thought about these kind of forgotten places and these forgotten moments in time. And for me, I find a lot of comfort and solace in being somewhere that's very remote and there's no people and there's no functionality. But I also think a lot about what that means for us as human beings and our relationship to the landscape and how quickly things become obsolete and they get forgotten about and they get left out to their own devices out in the wild. There's a photographer I like named Todd Hito, and he talked about, you know, when your project is done, when you're not motivated to get out of the car and take the photo anymore. And at the end of my trip in Alaska, I just had that experience. Alaska is so incredible, so wild, so many places to photograph. I really had to pace myself and be patient because I only had so much film that I brought with me. I really had to be careful about not shooting everything in just a single day. So I had a really great experience going up to the Arctic and hanging out in the southern parts of Alaska on the shore. And the entire experience was incredible. I got to ride in someone's plane. They flew me up onto Denali, the mountain, photograph up there. So overall, just a really incredible state. One of my favorite places I've ever been. Normally, I need to apply for grants before I do things like this. But in this case, I had wanted to go to Alaska for a long time. It was the last state I had not been to. And I thought, you know, I just need to do it now while I have the time and I have the money to go. So I just went on my own to finish this series.
And you said you were there for a month? So yeah. You just drive around, pick your shot.
Exactly. So that was one reason I took the ferry, is because I could bring my car onto the ferry. And I camped in my car out in the wilderness. I camped out in the national parks, occasionally slept indoors when the need arose. But this was near the end of the summer, beginning into the fall. So there was not a lot of tourists there at that point, and it was getting to be almost winter. But a really incredible experience. I'm really grateful I got to go.
It's such a beautiful photo. I mean, the bit I like is how the trees from the lighthouse image are picked out in the blue of the water. I think it's an ocean bay, right? Of the from Alaska. The foreground, you know, you've got two kinds of rocky beach overlaying each other, but the vast. Well, I guess the most of the top two-thirds of the image is just white with this sort of ghostly mountain range in the background.
Yeah, and I think a lot about texture in images, and I think a lot about perspective and scale between these two locations, and I really like to play with the idea of how large something that we know in our minds would be much larger than the other object. I really like to think about that when I make my images as well. But I also like to leave a lot of information. That's one benefit to shooting large format, is it captures so much detail, that there's so much information there that, you know, every time you look at it, you see something different, and you explore it. When you explore it more fully, you can start to see different blending and different incidents within the image. So I feel like it's something you can really build a personal connection with for that reason.
My name is Joseph Galliman. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is landscape photographer Mike Voss. Mike's show Fragile Tenuous Worlds is on now at Laura Vincent Design and Gallery through the end of July in Old Town. So Mike, this is kind of, from looking at your book, this is more what I was expecting of this show. So it's a bridge with a water tower kind of in it. Yeah, I guess the water tower is behind the bridge and we're looking through the arch. Stone bridge with this water tower with like little ladder going up the side and railings on the top. Lots of kind of trees in the foreground, and then this hazy, you know, waterfall, like you see on a calendar, right? Long exposure. Yeah. Everyone loves that image of a waterfall that's been sort of allowed to run, and that's just pouring out the middle of the picture, so it's coming from nowhere to me. You said this was up on Mount Rainier and people can go see the water tower, right?
Yeah, so there's you know, like you mentioned before, I really like to experiment with exposure, time, depending on what I want to say with the image, you know, using some technical tricks within the camera to highlight certain aspects of movement and things like that. You know, there's not often a lot of movement in nature, so when there is an opportunity to photograph it, I really like to show that there's movement there. And I mentioned before, but there is this water tower here. It actually has a mural painted on the outside of it of a very lush nature scene, which I thought was really interesting, and it's in this very industrial part of Washington. To me, you know, with this like very rigid, old, rusty building, it was very stark and kind of alarming to see this very intricate mural painted on the side of this. And to me, it really spoke to the human desire and need to be still connected to nature, even within this kind of industrial landscape. So I thought a lot about that when I was making this image, and I wanted to kind of capture more natural scenes and blend them within that to kind of hide not only the mural, but almost hide the water tower as well within this landscape. And as I mentioned before, there's some unpredictable things that happen. So there was some blending there that I didn't anticipate, but I do think that it made for an interesting image later on.
So some of the trees that were in the state national park are the kind of look like the trees that are painted on the side of the water towers. It's a kind of camouflage effect. Just to get this straight, the bridge and the waterfall are together in the state park.
Yes.
And the water tower is off in some other place.
Yeah, and I mentioned before that I do want to communicate a straightforward idea and have recognizable shapes. But for this one, I wanted to experiment with photographing a location that was very confusing visually, even on its own, because there's a bridge and there's a waterfall underneath the bridge, and there's some different lines that are running through as well. So it looks like there's more than two exposures here, but there's actually only two. And, you know, I think that with that experimentation of showing people my work, it's something that I am still learning, is what people will connect with emotionally, what people will think when they see an image like this. And to be honest, I didn't intend for this image to make it into the final version of my book. But when I worked with another photographer on my monograph and was sequencing the book, she insisted that this image stay in there. So that was, to me, interesting to see another person's perspective of my own work, and it gave me a different appreciation for it.
So that one was called A Pathway Lost in Time, and which kind of the title could work for the next one, which is, again, Alaska, a snowy mountain that it looks a bit like Mount St. Helens, you know, kind of like the side has been blown off a conical volcano, but I guess it's not. But in the foreground is all this rusty metal stuff. It looks like a giant series of big pipes, and then like a metal gate made up of panels with big rivets, and then these two kind of drums with sort of filters on them. And you know, this is like old industrial stuff juxtaposed with a sort of timeless, pristine nature.
The relationship between this mountain and this mining equipment, because this is near an old mine just north of Anchorage in Alaska, and I think a lot about, you know, taking these pieces of equipment that are a bit of an eyesore and kind of changing them and adapting them into these almost surreal landscapes to get lost in. I think it's a way to kind of think about making do with what we have as human beings and just making the best of the situation that we're in, and really appreciating nature for all that it is while we can.
It's called Lassitude, Nausea. What literary source is that?
I'm a big fan of a writer named Fernando Pessoa. He's a Portuguese.
How do you spell that?
Pessoa is P-E-S-S-O-A. He was a poet. He was a lot of things, but he had a bunch of heteronyms that he wrote underneath, these different personalities and different identities that he had created. And one of his heteronyms was very in touch with nature and was very outspoken about its preservation. And that was a quote from a partial quote from one of the poems by that heteronym, by Fernando Pessoa.
What kind of writer was he? Like a surrealist?
This was pre-surrealism, but his work really spanned a lot of different genres. He wrote about the occult, he wrote about nature, he wrote about technology. Interestingly, the technology, when he wrote about it, it was almost in an ironic appreciation of technology. I wouldn't say that he was a Luddite or anything like that, but he definitely saw the drawbacks of certain advancements in human technology.
And then there's a couple more we really have to talk about. One, you went up near Tacoma and found this office building which has several layers, and under each window, it's sort of very horizontal, low slung, kind of five-story building, but each of the kind of balconies is overgrown with greenery. It looks like it was landscape, but you're saying it was overgrown?
Yeah, so this is an old office building that belonged to a logging company, and it's vacant now, but the way that it was built was meant to blend into the landscape. And when you're driving up the 5 from Portland to Seattle, you'll see it on the side of the road. if you look, and it is very striking when you see it from a distance. It's hard to tell exactly what it is because it just looks like a large rectangle disappearing into a hillside. But when you go there and you start to explore, there's no one out there, but it is a maintained property. So there's someone mowing the grass, there's people that tend to the plants. And so there's almost this kind of eerie kind of science fiction feel to the landscape there. And I really like to photograph in places where I start to feel that, because I think that the image can convey that if I photograph it. So it is a very strange place, and I'd always been interested in it. And one day when I was driving up to Seattle, I just pulled over and started exploring, and then I took my camera out. And then the other layer is a river up on Mount Rainier National Park. It's one of my favorite places. And the river is actually inverted, so it's actually flowing upwards through this building.
So you just flip the negative before you put it in the camera?
Yeah, so with there's actually a point in time when I changed the 4x5 camera that I used for this series. The original 4x5 I used is about 100 years old, and it had very limited functionality. But the newer one that I use is called a Linhof, and there's a way to rotate the back, and you can rotate without having to rotate the entire camera. You can just rotate where the holder sits, and you can photograph in whatever direction you want.
So, but the upside down river, we see like little reflections of kind of birch trees, you know, and there's a bit of white in the sky, which you pointed out is not the sky, it's not clouds, it's glare off the river. So it's very subtle, it's very in the background, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the river bits in the sky, you can see that there's some movement there. There's a bit of a streakiness to them. And, you know, in the pond in front of the building, you can see the trees inverted, so it almost looks like a reflection. But as you follow the tree up, there's no tree there to be reflecting in the pool. So I don't normally flip one of the exposures in this way or invert them like that. I generally tend to have things more straightforward and easier to understand. But in this moment, I really wanted to capture that experience of looking into this pond and seeing a reflection for a world that's not actually there. And especially because this place felt so surreal, it felt like I stepped through a, you know, wormhole and I was in a completely different place.
Is this like Urbex? You have to hop a fence and hide?
No, actually, this is just drive into the parking lot and park, and there's no gates. There was no security. I thought at one point that maybe somebody would come and ask me what I was doing, but I was there for a couple hours, and no one ever showed up. So,
and then finally, there's the front end of a small airplane. You said you could probably see 100, and its front door is open. It looks like one of the windshield windows is broken out, and you know, it's kind of getting a bit mossy. It's an abandoned plane. You can see the wheels, and there's a fuel drum, a yellow metal drum underneath it, and then a series of trees. There's foliage that I think comes from near the plane, and then there's big fir trees from somewhere else sort of covering the bottom of the nose.
Yeah, so this plane was, funny you mentioned Urbex, because a lot of what I photograph, it requires a little bit of that experience of finding these places. And this is an abandoned plane out in the woods in the north of Alaska, not far from Fairbanks. And this plane is a commercial passenger plane. It could probably fit about 100 people in it, but it was just out in the woods, just on its own, and I went and photographed it. Again, a very strange experience. I had never seen anything like that. There was no other indication that this was like a plain graveyard or anything like that. It's just out in a field. And the trees are actually up in the Arctic. So I drove up the Dalton Highway during my time in Alaska.
Oh, wow. Did you get to the end?
Not all the way to Prudhoe Bay, but I did get to Weissman and Coldfoot. So that's mostly where I wanted to go to photograph, because the original intention was I wanted to photograph the Northern Lights. But because it was overcast both of the nights that I was there, I didn't end up getting to do that. But there were a lot of really incredible things up there. For one, the way that the trees grow up in the Arctic, because it's such an extreme climate, they almost have this kind of Dr. Seuss quality to them. They get really twisted, and they're short and skinny, and it's really bizarre. I had never seen anything like that. So I wanted to photograph those trees, and there's many other images I made when I was up in the Arctic, but the experience overall was incredible and scary and exciting, and I had a really amazing time making these images, but I think that the strangeness of the place, I think, can come through the image.
But there's no monitor, right? And there's no electronics. You see an image on the back of the camera, which is on like glass, ground glass, like the old days?
Exactly. So there is a ground glass I can look through that goes directly through the lens, and then all of the image is inverted, so everything is upside down. So I really have to think about that when I'm photographing too, and kind of see that inverted image as right side up when I'm making the second exposure.
But when you shoot the second image, are you sacrificing the first one? I mean, you're risking losing if you mess it up, right?
That's exactly right. So if the second exposure, if something goes wrong, if the slide falls out and the film falls out of the camera, that's ruined. If I expose at the wrong time or the wrong f-stop for this second exposure, then the entire thing becomes moot. So there is a high level of failure here. So it is motivation to get things right, be very slow, be very intentional. And that really just adds to the experience for me of just being very patient with my work and being very patient when making my images. And it's something that I think a lot of landscape photographers can relate to, of just that solitude, that solitariness of being out in the woods and really taking your time and thinking, you know, I could take this photo or I could wait till this cloud moves over here and that might be better. So mm-hmm. I think there's a level of patience that's necessary in making that kind of work, and adding a second exposure just even adds more to that.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was landscape photographer Mike Voss. His show, Fragile, Tenuous Worlds, is on now at Laura Vincent Design and Gallery at 824 Northwest Davis through the end of July. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Mike.
Thank you for having me, Joseph.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Have him on my wall. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver stream. Can't tell them apart at all.
Estás escuchando KBOO Portland.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes 24 de junio.